The plan is, as Father mentions, I'm going to talk about infinite creator and finite creation, Aquinas and the eternity of the world debate. The basic plan is I want to give a general, what I call geography of the debate. What are the positions on the eternity of the world that were staked out, especially in the Middle Ages? I want to give you a quick overview of Aquinas' position in that debate and his arguments for it. Okay, I want to evaluate those arguments. I am actually suspicious of them in some ways, right? In a lot of ways. And then I want to look at his attempt at refutations of other people's arguments in the debate, about which I'm much more optimistic. Okay, and then finally, I want to answer what I think is St. Bonaventure's best objection to St. Thomas's criticism of one of those arguments. So that's the plan. We'll see if we can do all that. Okay, first of all, in way of introduction to the debate, the eternity of the world debate is something that, you know, as I looked into this to prepare for the lecture, really runs, it's been with us as long as there's been philosophy. I think in some ways you can see the pre-Socratics are worrying about this issue. Plato and Aristotle have their different views on this issue. It runs to the Middle Ages. Early moderns, this is a key issue. You know, Kant, as I'm going to talk about this, makes this debate one of his antinomies in the Critique, right? Really, when people talk about arguments for God's existence in contemporary philosophy and religion, they're mainly talking unawares about the debate about the eternity of the world from the medieval period. Okay, one thing to note, though, for the medievals, it doesn't really have a whole lot to do with arguments for God's existence, right? It's an issue in and of itself. A couple of points, you know, just in the way of stage setting. I don't like eternity in the name for this debate, okay? Because when we hear eternity, especially in the Thomistic natural theological tradition, what we hear there is something more akin to God's timelessness, right? That things are eternal in as much as they aren't subject to change, they aren't subject to temporal description at all, etc., etc. No one in this debate is really saying anything like that about the world, okay? I think it's better to think of this as, even though this is the way the debate is talked about, you know, in like the important anthologies, even Thomas's short treatise on this is probably best translated as the title, as On the Eternity of the World. I think it would be better to say what we're talking about is the infinity of the world here, right? Whether or not the world is infinite in a temporal sense. And what I mean by that is the world, does the world have an infinite past, right? And will it have an infinite future? Okay, those are the questions. Okay. Now, a few things we should say about what we mean by world too before we jump in. And here I'll pick up with the prepared lecture. Some comments on what is meant by world are appropriate. Certainly words such as universe or cosmos are good candidate synonyms for world. And certainly what we mean by world is probably something like natural world. Nevertheless, I once again counsel restraint. Universe and cosmos carry connotations of a structured, law-governed, or otherwise unified system of nature. And there is no reason to foreclose against an earlier, chaotic stage of an evolving world without good reason for doing so at this point. Maybe the law-governed universe is finite, but the world in a prior chaotic stage beyond our scientific ken is infinite in duration. One might then be tempted just to think of the world as matter. But what matter ultimately is, and whether it comes to be or passes away, is itself no source of small controversy. In the ancient and medieval treatments of the debate, world is mostly taken, in my reckoning, to be a collection of mobile or changing beings. So the question of the infinity of the world comes to whether, leading up to the present state of the universe, there has been an infinite series of prior changes of state, or law governed or otherwise. This is certainly how St. Thomas and St. Bonaventure seem to frame the issue, so that is how I now pose the question. Of course, this approach begs some weighty questions regarding the relationship between time and change, and which likely have consequences for our conclusions regarding the prior infinity of the world. But these are actually questions that St. Thomas and St. Bonaventure, I think, answer more or less the same. So we'll do well not to wade in those treacherous waters at this point, though it probably will come up. Okay, our dialectical geography. As I mentioned earlier, Kant takes up the infinity of the world as one of his famous antinomies of pure reason. Kant notes the seeming impeccability of the traditional proof for the finitude of the world based on the premise that, quote, if one assumes that the world has no beginning in time, then up to every point in time an eternity has elapsed. And hence, an infinite series of states of the world, each following another, has passed away, end quote. Here, Kant summarizes what I call a finitist position. That is, the claim that the debate can be resolved at the first order level by an already available proof demonstrating that the world is finite. On Kant's gloss, the argument, this argument, which is highly intuitive to many historically significant philosophers and the proverbial man on the street, basically runs to the effect that the world must have a beginning at a finitely distant point in the past, because there simply cannot be an infinite series of events that have actually occurred leading up to the present. Otherwise, we would have to say there was a completed or actual infinity of moments leading up to the present, which is at least prima facie impossible. This is more or less the basic line of reasoning followed by some of the great Muslim philosophers of the Middle Ages and contemporary proponents of the updated Kalam argument for God's existence. So here on your handout, I give you just a basic scheme for that argument, the finitist argument. Premise one, if the world is infinite, then there has been an infinite series of actually occurring events and or moments leading up to the present. Premise two, it is impossible for there to have been an infinite series of actually occurring events and or moments leading up to the present, and therefore the world is finite. Notice the ambiguity between actually occurring events and moments is intentional, as for classical medieval philosophers, at least in the Aristotelian tradition, changes undergone by material substances, what I'm calling events, and the movement of time are inextricable. Not the same thing, but inextricable. So we can come at the issue from either direction and probably get the same result. As we shall see, St. Bonaventure is a finitist, whose most important contribution to the debate is a defense of the second premise that we've highlighted, against some of St. Thomas's objections. The finitist argument is all well and good, but Kant believes that there is an equally compelling, even demonstrative in some sense, proof to the contrary on the offer. If we accept the finitist conclusion, then we have to say that there was a bounded first moment or event, that is, a moment for which there is no prior moment. As Kant glosses it, quoting Kant, there must be a preceding time in which the world was not, that is, an empty time. But now, no arising of any sort of thing is possible in an empty time, because no part of such a time has in itself, prior to another part, any distinguishing condition rather than its non-existence, whether one assumes that it comes to be itself or through another cause. In other words, if the world came to be at a certain moment, then there can be no explanation as to why it came to be at this moment rather than another. Such inexplicability for the coming to be of the world is unacceptable, so we must accept an infinitist conclusion, that is, the world is infinite in duration. The line of argument Kant presents here is not uncommon. He's taking it from the Leibniz-Clark debate, I take it. You can see Augustine raises something like this worry, though I don't think it's his view in the Confessions. We could come up with more examples. Despite its influence, there is good reason to be dubious about this argument. If we are querying why the world came to be at this moment rather than some other moment, then we are presupposing that there were moments before the coming to be of the world. That is, the proponent of this argument assumes that there must be empty time prior to the coming to be of a finite world. If there were empty moments prior to the coming to be of the world, then it would be reasonable to ask why the universe came to be during any one of them rather than some other. Surely nothing about any of these moments would recommend an explanation for the coming to be of the universe. They are supposedly empty, after all. Not even God could have a good reason for picking one empty moment over another, so there could be no explanation for the coming to be of the universe. That's all well and good, but why suppose that prior to the coming to be of a finite universe, there must have been a series of empty moments, finite in number or otherwise? At the very least, this assumption begs the question against the classical Aristotelian view of time, which takes time as the quantity of motion among mobile beings. On such a view, there can be no empty moments. Moreover, the proponent of this argument likewise seems to beg the question against the relationalist views of time that also rule out the notion of empty time, at least on my view of them. Thus, we have plausible alternatives in our thinking about time that avoid the argument for this side of Kant's antinomy. So if you want to weasel out of the antinomy, you have room. Okay. But maybe it's not so bad for the infinitist as all of that. I think that what is really going on in this argument is something of a hangover from a much more interesting argument from Aristotle, which is the proof that primarily motivated the infinitist position in the Middle Ages. Okay. So this is text one on the handout. I'm going to read this one, actually. This is from Aristotle's Physics. Plato alone asserts the creation of time, saying that it is simultaneous with the world and that the world came into being. Now, since time cannot exist and is unthinkable apart from now, and now is a kind of middle point, uniting as it does in itself both a beginning and an end, a beginning of future time and an end of past time, it follows that there must always be time, for the extremity of the last period of time that we take must be found in some now, since in time we can take nothing but nows. Therefore, since now is both a beginning and an end, there must always be time on both sides of it. But if this is true of time, it is evident that it must be true of motion, time being a kind of affection of motion. So here's what I take it that Aristotle is up to here, what I call the infinitist argument. Premise one, if the world is finite, then there was a first moment before which there was no prior moment. Premise two, it is impossible that there be a first moment before which there was no prior moment. Therefore, three, the world is infinite. Notice that there is no gross assumption that a finite universe entails the occurrence of any empty time. Indeed, Aristotle will have nothing of the idea of empty time. Rather, his worry is that the very notion of a first moment is incoherent. It is contrary to the very definition of moment. The second premise is where all the work is done in the infinitist argument. Aristotle supports it with the claim that every moment, every present, is always a middle point between a past moment and a future moment as a matter of logical or metaphysical necessity. Thus, a moment before which or after which there is no prior or subsequent moment is an impossibility in the most absolute sense. Thus, the world cannot have a first moment. And as you have already likely concluded, nor can it have a final moment. Since time and change are inextricable, as we're supposing, the world of mobile being is temporally infinite in both directions, right? Forward and backward. There are a number of other arguments for the infinity of the world that were proffered by medieval infinitists and even Aristotle, but this is the one I think that was the most influential. So we're going to just use that. Now, Kant is having nothing of either of these positions. That is not because he believes that they have reasoned poorly, or even that at the first order level they have explicitly appealed to a premise that is obviously false. The debate constitutes an antinomy for Kant, a conceptual trap that a common misuse of reason leads the overly ambitious metaphysician into. Both sides, says Kant, suffer from a shared blunder, that is, realism about time. The finitist and the infinitist both tacitly assume that the world is in itself temporal, and therefore we can demonstrate one way or another whether the quantity of its temporality is either finite or infinite. This assumption leads to contradictory conclusions, so we have a demonstration against it. At least that's what Kant thinks. Thus, Kant does not attempt to resolve the issue, but dissolve it by opting for anti-realism about time. Temporality is something we project into a numinally atemporal ultimate world. At least that's how I read Kant. I know that's probably controversial because it's a reading of Kant. Okay, so if anyone's writing a dissertation on Kant on time, I will accept correction. Okay. Now, like Kant, St. Thomas does not attempt to resolve the debate either way. St. Thomas recognizes that both the infinitist and the finitist positions have considerable intellectual grip. Unlike Kant, however, Aquinas does not endorse anything akin to anti-realism about time. Following Aristotle, St. Thomas takes time as the quantity of motion among mobile beings, and mobility is in fact the most apparent thing to the senses in his view. Thus, for Aquinas, time is real indeed. Rather than defending anti-realism about time, St. Thomas argues for, and I want to be careful with the title, okay, but I'll explain it, skeptical fideism about the finitude of the world. Okay, skeptical fideism about the finitude of the world. Okay, skeptical because Aquinas believes he can demonstrate that there can be no demonstration one way or another regarding the infinity or finitude of the world, the ultimate duration of which is beyond our rational ken. Okay, so Aquinas thinks there's a fact of the matter of the duration of the world, right? It's just beyond our ken to rationally demonstrate what that is. I say fideism because St. Thomas does indeed believe the world is finite, but only because he believes that, quote, in the beginning, or excuse me, just that the in the beginning of Genesis commits the Catholic to such a conclusion. We need to be cautious here, because I think there's a tendency to think that St. Thomas is somehow agnostic about the finitude of the world. He is not, right? He's perfectly convinced, maybe with a one probability, right? We debated last night, that the world is finite. He just thinks it's something that comes to him de fide. He's perfectly convinced of this. It's just that it comes de fide, right? It's not something we can demonstrate. Okay. As I put here, that conviction, however, can only come de fide and not via rational demonstration, though St. Thomas does at one point, which I'm going to make a lot of hay of later, okay, concede that the argument for the finitist position is probable, or more strictly, he says, it's not devoid of probability. As St. Thomas puts it, like the doctrine of the Trinity, quote, by faith alone do we hold, and by no demonstration can it be proved that the world did not always exist. Okay. So here's your geography. You could claim to prove the world is finite. You could claim to prove the world is infinite. You could go scientific anti-realism and say there's just no fact of the matter. Okay. Or you could go what I'm calling skeptical fideism and say, no, there is a fact of the matter. It's beyond our rational ken, but it's been revealed to us one way or another via scripture or some such. Okay. So I think Thomas owes us some things now. I want that demonstration that there's no demonstration. Okay. But then also I think he needs to show us that the purported demonstrations for the finitist or the infinitist position somehow fail. Otherwise, we're going to be weighing demonstrations, okay? So let's go into the demonstrations against the demonstrations where I think I'm going to get in trouble, okay? In the first part, the Summa, question 46, St. Thomas asks whether it is possible to demonstrate the infinity or finitude of the world one way or another. In the first article he asks, he argues that no demonstration of the infinity of the world is possible with the following remarks. I'm going to read this text because it's going to be important for us. Nothing except God can be eternal, and this statement is far from impossible to uphold, for it has been shown above that the will of God is the cause of things. Therefore, things are necessary according as it is necessary for God to will them, since the necessity of the effect depends on the necessity of the cause. Now, it was shown above that, absolutely speaking, it is not necessary that God should will anything except himself. It is not, therefore, necessary for God to will that the world should always exist, but the world exists for as much as God wills it to exist, since the being of the world depends on the will of God as on its cause. It is not, therefore, necessary for the world to be always, and hence it cannot be proved by demonstration. End quotation. Aquinas' point here is that only necessary truths can be demonstrated, and he can demonstrate that it is not necessarily true that the world is temporally infinite. His point seems to be that the world is necessarily infinite only in as much as God wills it to be so. To be so necessarily. Certainly, the divine freedom dictates that God does not necessarily will that the world come to be at all. Creation is a free act. Thus, it is not a necessary truth that there is an infinite world, even if there actually is one, and we then likewise have a demonstration to the effect that there cannot be a demonstration of the temporal infinity of the world. As far as I can tell, this is what St. Thomas is up to in this passage, and I call this Aquinas' argument contra the necessity that the world is temporally infinite. A clumsy title, but Here's the argument as I see it. If the world is necessarily infinite, then it must be necessary that God will that the world is infinite. It is not necessary that God will that the world is temporally infinite. Therefore, the world is not necessarily infinite. Okay, maybe I'm not quite understanding Aquinas, what Aquinas is doing here, but I'm a bit troubled by this line of reasoning as it stands. Namely, I fear that there's an equivocation going on behind the word necessary as applied to the world and its infinity. Do we mean de dicto that it is necessary that an infinite world exists, or do we mean de re that necessarily if a world exists, it is infinite? It seems to me that the antecedent of premise one, and in that antecedent, Aquinas must have in mind whether an infinite world's existence is necessary or contingent, that is the de dicto notion of necessity, and likewise for premise two. I think to make the thing work, it's got to be de dicto. Thus, the conclusion can only be understood as making the de dicto claim that the existence of an infinite world, right? Excuse me, that the existence of an infinite world is a contingent state of affairs whenever it obtains. So I think all he's shown here is that if there's a world, there didn't have to be one. Okay. Notice, however, that such a conclusion is not at all to the point under consideration. Rather, the worry is not over the contingency of an infinite world, but over whether the world, if there is one, is contingently or necessarily infinite. That is, the de re notion of necessity is the relevant concern. The question is not whether it was within God's power to fail to create a world, whatever its duration, but whether if God creates a world, must it be infinite? Thus, Aquinas' argument, as it seems to me anyway, does not address the issue. This case is best made by example. It is a contingent fact that water exists, and God is certainly free to decide whether he will create any liquid at all, water or otherwise. Nevertheless, it is necessarily true that if there is to be water, then that stuff will be composed of H2O molecules. Thus, we might say, leaving aside sticky worries about demonstrating necessarily true empirical facts and scientific realism and such, that it is necessary that water is H2O. Even though God need not have willed that there be water at all. Though water exists contingently, it has an essence dictating that should any water exist, it will necessarily be composed of H2O molecules. For many people, including contemporary subscribers to Aristotelian realism, this point is a philosophical commonplace. So let's apply it to the infinity of the world. It might be necessarily true that the world is infinite whenever it exists without it being necessarily the case that the world exists. That is, it could be the case that God need not will that there be a world at all. The act of creation is undetermined, certainly. While it is still necessarily true that if God creates a world, it must be temporally infinite, because that is simply dictated by the nature of mobile being in general. Okay. So I worry about that particular concern. All right. Now, let's go to Article 2, where Aquinas says... So in Article 1, he says, I think I can show you it's impossible to demonstrate that the world is infinite, right? And then in Article 2, he says, well, I'm going to demonstrate to you that it's impossible to demonstrate that the world is finite, okay? So if you look at Text 3, the second part of Text 3 really is a very similar argument to the one we just discussed. So I'm going to just leave that aside because I think it'll all be the same worry. So I just want to read the first half of Text 3 to get what the argument that Thomas has in mind there. So, by faith alone do we hold, and by no demonstration can it be proved that the world did not always exist, as was said above of the mystery of the Trinity. The reason of this is that the newness of the world cannot be demonstrated on the part of the world itself, for the principle of demonstration is the essence of a thing. Now everything according to its species is abstracted from here and now, once it is said that are everywhere and always. Okay. So in this passage, St. Thomas actually makes two arguments against proving that the world is finite, and I'm only going to discuss the first one I just read to you. In the first argument, he appeals to the nature of Aristotelian demonstration. Such demonstration only appeals to the abstracted essence of the object, and therefore it leaves aside any particular accidents of such beings. For example, a demonstration regarding frogs can draw conclusions about their amphibian nature, but not the particular spatial or temporal occurrences of any such creatures. You know, simply knowing that Kermit is a frog doesn't tell us his age or where he is. Thus, Aquinas argues that there can be no demonstration about the particular temporal quantity of the world, since that would be to go beyond the essential to the accidental, which is always beyond the scope of demonstration. Sure, we can get some probabilities about frog accidents based on their essential natures. For instance, it's likely you'll find them near water, they'll have access to flies, etc., etc., but those are probabilities. All right, so the actual duration of the world would seem to be an accidental attribute of the world. So we can have no absolute demonstration of such a duration. Maybe we can say it's probable that the world is finite, but the certainties of faith trump probabilities. If St. Thomas's argument is sound, we would then have a demonstration that there can be no demonstration at all regarding the actual duration of the world. Okay. Here, too, I fear that the argument is less than convincing, though. First of all, notice that the claim that the finitude of the world is accidental probably begs the question in this context. The essential finitude of the world is exactly what the finitist purports to have demonstrated. Okay. I really don't like begging the question charges because they always cut both ways, so let's just let that go. Okay, see if we can do better. Now, Aquinas is correct to claim that we cannot offer a demonstration of the duration of any particular substance by contemplating its essence. All right. That's fair enough, okay. But notice this about our frog Kermit. He is mortal, as are all frogs. And maybe Kermit's mortality is not technically essential to him in the traditional sense. It would not enter into a proper definition of his being a frog, okay. Be that as it may, Kermit's mortality is not a contingent attribute, though, either. It is a logical property, or propria. An accidental attribute that follows from or is entailed by his essence. Thus, though Kermit's actual age or eventual lifespan are accidental and therefore indemonstrable, his status as a being that will ultimately snuff it, right, is something that we can indeed demonstrate based on our knowledge of his nature qua frog. Okay. Well, the analogy between our frog example and the ultimate duration of the world should be clear. Clearly, there is no way to demonstrate the actual duration of the world in the Aristotelian sense, or its ultimate lifespan. However, that is not to say that no demonstration can be made regarding its finitude or infinity. I'm happy to grant that infinite and finite are, you know, accidental. Nevertheless, just like our mortal frog, it may be the case that the ultimate duration of the universe is a necessary accident entailed by its essence per se. The world may be mortal just like Kermit, or immortal like an angel, and these sorts of propria are indeed demonstrable from the very nature of such beings. The notion of the essential nature of the world does strike me as obscure, right? It seems like there's some kind of like compositional fallacy lurking in there somewhere, right? So I'll admit I'm worried about that. But when we realize that all we mean by the world is the occurrence of mobile being, that suspicion seems to be somewhat assuaged, right? We've got a nature of mobility that we could ask, could it go on forever, or must it have gone on forever? Okay. All right, so I'm not convinced at all that Thomas has proven there can be no proof in this vicinity, okay? So now I want to turn and look at his attempts to refute the proofs for the finitist and the infinitist positions that are on offer, okay, which we've already looked at. So recall Aristotle's infinitist proof you have in your handout. As we discussed earlier, all the work is done in premise two, and that's the claim that it is impossible that there be a moment before which there is a first moment, before which there is no first moment. And Aristotle defends it by defining the very notion of a moment or a temporal present as a transition point between a past moment and a future moment. Every present is a movement from past to future, and therefore the notion of a bound moment, a moment with neither a past nor a future, is ultimately incoherent. St. Thomas makes two primary cases against Aristotle's premise two. In the interest of time, we're only going to look at one of them. This is text 4. And aside from the other arguments, which he does not touch upon here, this is quoting Thomas, it is evident that the arguments which he does give here to prove time is eternal are not demonstrative. For if we suppose that at some moment time began to be, it is not necessary to assume a prior moment except in imaginary time. Just as when we say there is no body outside of the heavens, what we mean by outside is merely an imaginary something. Okay, so that's probably all we need from the quote. Here's my explanation. Here Aquinas argues that the fact that we cannot imagine a bound moment is not alone enough to show that there can be no such thing. In the same way that bounded space, or a spatially finite universe, conjures pictures of a space beyond space and, you know, all the puzzles, you know, can you throw a rock over the edge of space, or how thick is the wall dividing space from non-space, the notion of bound moments suggests images of a prior time to all time, which is, of course, an absurdity that will cause metaphysical trouble. Aquinas' point, however, is that to the spatial finitist, space beyond space is nothing. There is no such thing. And puzzling over how thick the wall binding space might be is to fall into what Elizabeth Anscombe calls bad picture thinking. Likewise, the temporal finitist claims that the time before the first moment is nothing. There is no such time, and puzzling is bewitchment by our imaginations. Aquinas sees no need to define the notion of a moment as a past to future transition. So there is no reason to think our imaginations are particularly instructive on this matter. At the very least, there are sufficiently plausible alternative ways of thinking about the present that do not merely reduce it to a past to future transition. And this notion has raised enough seemingly intractable puzzles that we do well not to settle into such a conception with much haste. Okay. So however understandable Aristotle's error might be, we are within our rights to conclude that he has erred in this case. He's made a mistake. Or at least we should conclude that one does well to suspend judgment regarding the second premise of the infinitist proof. Okay. Let's talk about, and this, I think this is much more interesting, Aquinas' refutation of the proof for the infinitude of the world. Okay, so recall the finitist argument. It's still in your handout. And once again, here too, the second premise, right, is where all the work is going to get done. All right. So St. Thomas rejects premise two because he maintains that certain sorts of infinite causal series are impossible. Okay. That is, Aquinas claims that it is epistemically possible. Excuse me, I said impossible here. Let me start that again. St. Thomas rejects premise two because he maintains that certain sorts of infinite causal series are possible. That is, Aquinas claims that it is epistemically possible, proceeding from what is seen by faith, right, for all we know, that an infinite series of actually occurring events or moments have led up to the present moment. For all we know, that may well have occurred. No doubt, the notion that there can be infinite series of causally related events or moments that have actually occurred does offend against many people's basic intuitions. And to understand why St. Thomas stakes this seemingly odd claim, we will need to make some careful distinctions. Okay, first I want to distinguish between a multitude and a causal series, okay? I think Thomas really has this distinction in mind. There's one point in one of the quotes I give you where it seems like he uses them interchangeably, but I think the weight goes that he thinks there's a difference between a multitude and a series, okay? So first we need to distinguish between what St. Thomas calls a multitude and a causal series. A multitude, I take it, is a completed collection of things. Right, they're all together. For example, the set of books on my office shelf is a multitude, as would be the set of trees in the park. A causal series is an order of events or substances or constituents in which each iteration of the order is caused by its immediately prior iteration. Okay. For example, the set of events leading to the sinking of the eight ball or the collection of physiological processes enabling me to read this sentence are causal series. Notice that multitudes do not entail the existence of causal series. An arbitrarily collected set of things like the Eiffel Tower, my left shoe, and Mount Rushmore might constitute a multitude, but there is no causal ordering among them. In some cases, however, a causal series may entail the existence of a multitude. For example, the causal ordering of the physiological processes enabling me to read this sentence entails a multitude. All those processes occur simultaneously as a complete collection in order for me to write this sentence or read this sentence. At one point, St. Thomas denies that that an actually infinite multitude is possible. Not just denies it, he gives an argument for it. not just on the basis of human intuition, but for some rather interesting reasons. That is, he argues that it's impossible for there to be a completed collection of actually simultaneously existing things. Okay. This is text 6. I'm going to just skip to my explanation of it, because I don't think there's much controversy what he's saying here. In other words, any actually occurring collection of things must have a definite number of members, whatever the causal ordering or lack thereof among these members might be. There are, according to St. Thomas, no innumerable, uncountable occurrences in nature, and nor could there be. At least it seems like he's saying in this passage. This doesn't necessarily mean that St. Thomas believes there can be no metaphysical vagaries at all, but only that when it comes to a complete collection of things, there must be a fact of the matter as to how many things there are in such a collection. There is no fact of the matter as to how many members there are in an infinite multitude, so there can be no actually infinite multitude. Fair enough, or at least at this point, we're not going to put that into contention. Now, let's be careful, because we have only considered actually infinite multitudes, and Aquinas would have us distinguish that from actual infinities from potential infinities. Okay. Once again here, this is sort of famous, so I'm going to skip that quote and just go to my explanation. Following Aristotle, Aquinas has no problem granting that matter is infinitely divisible, though he denies that matter is ever infinitely divided. The former only entails a potentially infinite multitude, the infinity of the infinitely numerous divisions that could be made to a body, and not the actual infinite, right? The infinity divisions made to this body. The latter entails the occurrence of an actually infinite multitude, which is impossible, as Aquinas has argued. The divisibility of matter, at least on the Aristotelian story, and an endless number series give us good reason to conclude that potential infinities are in fact actual. There are potential infinities. Okay. All right, that's enough about multitudes. Let's focus now on causal series. St. Thomas, following Aristotle and his Arab commentators, distinguishes between absolute causal series, or what we call often per se causal series, and accidental, or what's often called per accidens causal series. The former is a causally ordered series in a very strong sense. Each subsequent iteration of the series requires the continued existence of all prior iterations of the series. For example, the series of physiological processes supporting my reading of the sentence is a per se absolute series. Should any of the more fundamental prior processes fail, all the higher order or posterior processes would fail. Thus, an infinite series of this sort would definitely entail the existence of an actually completed infinite multitude, which is impossible. And Aquinas says, yeah, there could be no infinite per se causal series. Okay. All right, now, the impossibility of an actually infinite multitude might be sufficient to conclude that an infinite per se causal series is impossible. But because if you have an infinite per se causal series, then there would have to be a corresponding infinite completed multitude. Okay. Let's leave that aside, all right, because there's still reason to doubt that such an infinite series is possible independently of what we think of multitudes, okay? I take it that the question here is one of explanation, and this seems to be how Aristotle thinks of these kinds of issues in his arguments for God, for the first cause. That is, if a subsequently occurring iteration of a series requires an in principle incomplete explanation, for example, an infinite series of simultaneously acting causes, then there is no reason for or explanation of that subsequent iteration of the series. By definition, a causal series is one in which every iteration of the series has an explanation in terms of the prior iterations. So there can be no infinite series of per se ordered causes. Fair enough. The point to take away, which will be important for later discussion, is that we can separate Aquinas' prohibition against infinite per se causal series, which he needs for the first cause arguments, from his apparent argument contrary to the possibility of actual infinite multitudes. He doesn't need that to make the first cause arguments work. Okay. Notice that this way of thinking about Aquinas' rejection of the infinite series of orders, of infinite series of causal orders, does not commit him to a strong or generalized version of the principle of sufficient reason. We need not take Aquinas as claiming that all facts have exhaustive explanations, only that the facts that lie in the train of a causal series have exhaustive explanations, and I see that as a trivial claim in a friendly sense, right? That's what it is to be in a causal series. Okay, None of this, however, is to say that all infinite series or even causally ordered infinite series are impossible. When we consider actually ordered series, Aquinas claims a different picture emerges. Okay, so we'll look at text 9. And really just the second half of it. But midway through, he picks up with "and likewise." I just don't like the example he uses in the first half. "And likewise, it is accidental to this particular man as generator to be generated by another man, for he generates as a man and not as the son of another man. For all men generating hold one great and efficient cause, the great of a particular generator. Hence, it is not impossible for a man to be generated by man to infinity, but such a thing would be impossible if the generations of this man depended upon this man and on an elementary body and on the sun and so on to infinity." So what Aquinas is saying there is he has no problem to say that there's been an infinite number of father-son relations leading up to me, because it doesn't presuppose that all those fathers and sons exist for me to go on and, you know, produce another generation, right? That would be embarrassing, right? Okay, right? And so, because he said this is an accidental causal relation, not a per se causal relation. It doesn't presuppose the existence of the entire series for each subsequent generation. Okay, and so if he says if that works, then it would seem we could have infinite prior series, and it seems then for all we know the world could be infinite. Okay, so in summary, St. Thomas seems to have proven, or at least sufficiently motivated, the following theses. A, absolute per se causal series cannot proceed to infinity. I think there's two ways he can do that. B, accidental per accidens causal series could proceed to infinity. C, there can be no actually infinite multitude, however it might be aggregated. And D, there could be, in fact, there are potentially infinite multitudes. Notice that that premise 2, the finitist argument, is now deeply suspect, since there is no reason to think that each subsequent moment or occurrence in the history of the world presupposes the continued existence of all prior moments or occurrences, there is subsequently no reason to maintain that an infinite prior history of the world entails an actually infinite multitude. Thus, for all we know, the universe may have an infinite prior history. Right? Then I give you the quotation in 10 where Aquinas makes this point. Okay. All right. Now, let's talk about an objection, what I call the infinite multitude of souls objection. All right, I'm not sure where it originates. I think it's probably in the Muslims. But what I find interesting is Bonaventure really pushes this one really hard on St. Thomas. Okay. So in a number of places, Aquinas considers an objection to his rejection of premise 2 of the finitist argument, which he admits is, quote, fairly difficult, this objection, as it would show that, quote, if the world has existed forever, the number of souls must now be infinite, right? So the objection is that, well, if the world's been around forever and we've been aggregating human beings forever, then you're going to have a completed aggregate, infinite aggregate of human souls hanging around in heaven, purgatory, or what have you, okay? So here's how Thomas spells out the worry in more detail. This is text 11, it's short. Further, if the world and generation always were, there have been an infinite number of men, but man's soul is immortal. Therefore, an infinite number of human souls would actually now exist, which is impossible. Therefore, it can be known with certainty that the world began, and not only is it known by faith. Okay. All right, the objection is that if the world has indeed endured for an infinite prior time, then there would have been an infinite number of prior generations of human beings, each member of which has an immortal soul. As such, there must be at present an actual infinite multitude of immortal human souls aggregated somehow in the hereafter. Thus, the eternity of the world does not entail merely a potentially infinite multitude of prior occurrences or moments, but also an actually infinite multitude of souls. On the assumption there can be no actually infinite multitude, it seems we do, after all, have a demonstration that the world is temporally finite. Okay. Now, Aquinas' immediate reply is a bit underwhelming. Okay, and we'll talk about why. So let's look at text 12. Some advocates of the eternity of the world have contended that human souls do not survive the body. Some have maintained that nothing remains of all the souls except a separate intellect, the agent intellect, in the opinion of some, or also the possible intellect, in the view of others. Some have imagined a rotation of souls, saying that the same souls return to the bodies after several centuries. And some hold that it is not impossible for things to be actually infinite. It is possible for it's not impossible for certain things to be actually infinite if there is no causal order among them. Okay. End quote. So in other words, those people who defend the eternity of the world or the infinity of the world have a lot of ways that they have tried to circumvent this sort of objection. For instance, many Arab commentators deny the immortality of the soul or entertain transmigration or monopsychic doctrines regarding the human soul. Others have denied that the actual infinite multitudes of accidentally related things are impossible when there is no causal ordering among them. That's all well and good, inasmuch as we are concerned with what the infinitists say about on their own behalf, but that is a far cry from showing that their apologies are at all plausible. Okay. And St. Bonaventure, in the passage here, I'm going to spare us, it's long, he says, well, but wait, don't we claim to have a bunch of demonstrations contrary to this? Like, don't we claim that we can demonstrate that the human soul is immortal, that it only comes back in the body that it was originally in, that, you know, the monopsychic doctrines are false, and then hasn't Thomas himself said, I just showed you there can't be infinite multitudes. Okay, so it's not clear that the... You know, the appeal to, well, here's what the Muslims say about this, is it all effective? Because Thomas himself claims to have a bunch of demonstrations contrary to what they say about this. Okay. Now, there's an easier way for Thomas to get out of this. And at one point he does it in the actual essay on the eternity of the world, where he just says, look, who says God had to be making humans for the entire duration of an infinite world? Maybe, you know, God 6,000 years ago just jumped in and threw the humans in, okay? So that doesn't entail, like, just the fact of the immortality of the soul itself doesn't entail the problem, okay? However, I think this is still a serious problem for St. Thomas. Okay, so about all that, I'm not so sure. Even if Aquinas gives us good reason to think that it is possible for there to be an eternal world with a finite number of humans, and I agree with him on that point, it still seems that on the hypothesis that there could have been an infinite world, there could have been an infinite number of human beings. God could just always have been creating humans. And therefore, there could have been a complete and infinite multitude of human souls. There isn't, but there could have been. Aquinas' position then entails that something is possible, which he himself seems to have demonstrated as impossible. You just see, it's just a higher order problem now. Okay, and I think Bill Craig pushes this on Thomas at one point too. Thus, it seems incoherent for Aquinas to claim that the world might have been infinite in duration. Okay. So I think Thomas's preferred way of getting out the objection is not convincing. Okay. But I think I can get him out of it. Okay. All right. So, final section. Probable arguments and the epistemic possibility of real infinite multitudes. Does this mean that the finitist carries the day, right? I mean, do the Franciscans win, right? Okay. Be careful with that. All right. I do want the check. Okay. So, well, okay, well, the situation may be a bit more complicated than all that. Consider the following remarks from St. Thomas. This is text 14. Since these arguments do not conclude with strict necessity, he's talking about the finitist argument here, although they are not entirely devoid of probability, I'm going to really hang on that probability thing, is enough to touch on them briefly so that the Catholic faith may not seem to rest on inept reasonings rather than on the unshakable basis of God's teaching. And so we deem it suitable to show how such arguments are met by those who have maintained the eternity of the world. All right. Now, interestingly, Aquinas here concedes that something like the finitist argument, though it does not strictly demonstrate its conclusion, is not entirely devoid of probability. What Thomas means by probability, I'm not quite sure. Okay, I take it that what St. Thomas means here, this is my guess, is that someone who accepts that the world is indeed temporally finite on the basis of the arguments we've discussed is not in some sort of egregious intellectual error. The argument at the end of the day is pretty good. We might even say that someone who accepts the finitude of the world on such a basis is epistemically justified, though maybe we don't, you know, they're not warranted. Okay. We might have to say that someone who doesn't accept such an argument is likewise within his or her epistemic rights, but that is not to say that the finitist is without traction. Maybe they have considerable traction. Certainly, however, I take it that the degrees of probability they can enjoy, short of strict demonstration, such that one would be unreasonable. I take it that there are degrees of probability that an argument can enjoy, short of strict demonstration, such that one would be unreasonable to doubt it. Only faith can deliver certainty about the finitude of the world, but reason can get us a good way along that path. Curiously, and I'm unaware that St. Thomas says this much in favor of the infinitist position. Aristotle's errors are understandable, but they are still errors and don't seem to give us even probable arguments. Now, maybe he says it somewhere. I'm happy to be corrected on that. But it seems that at least the argument we looked at, he just says there's a logical gaffe here. It just doesn't work at all. Whereas the finitist argument comes from Bonaventure and says, yeah, it's pretty good. It's not demonstrable, but it's pretty good. This is all especially interesting in light of the fact that at one point, when addressing the infinity of the soul's objection, St. Thomas does claim, in a number of places he does this, quote, no demonstration, he doesn't just say, they say this, he says, no demonstration has yet been forthcoming that God cannot produce a multitude that is actually infinite. Okay, now even though it seemed like he gave us a demonstration of that a while back, okay, but in the Eternity of the World, I don't know the historical order of the texts, what have you. I'd love to hear about that. He does say there's no demonstration that you can't have with God's power an infinite multitude, an actually infinite multitude. Okay. I'm not sure that this is in fact consistent with Aquinas' apparent argument against all actually infinite multitudes that we discussed earlier. But let's leave that aside for now. I'm aware of some commentators who say he just contradicts himself between question 7 and question 46. But it seems that what is going on here is that for St. Thomas, the finitist argument is non-demonstrative, even if probable, because the principle motivating his key premise is itself non-demonstrable, even if highly probable. That is, since there is no absolute demonstration that God cannot create an actually infinite multitude, though Aquinas thinks this is probably the case, there is no absolute demonstration that the world is finite, though Aquinas thinks this is probably the case. Thus, even though we have pretty good reasons to think that the world is finite, for all we know for certain, right, proceeding from the certainty of faith, it may well be infinite. Does this mean that St. Thomas is simply inconsistent in his assessment of the possibility of actually infinite multitudes? I don't believe we need saddle the angelic doctor with inconsistency at this point. Recall this passage we highlighted earlier, quote, and some hold that it is not impossible for certain things to be actually infinite if there is no causal order among them. Given this passage and the one we just highlighted, two important considerations arise. First, Aquinas claims that it might be possible for God to create an actually infinite multitude. I mean, that you just said. And secondly, God can only do that if there is no causal ordering among the members of the multitude. So given that first claim, it seems that we are not talking about a multitude collected by a temporal process of aggregation, bit by bit, as it were. God creates atemporally. A multitude would come all at once, an internal instant by the single act of a first cause. Further, since the multitude is not a causal order, the ultimate explanation would not come from within it. Thus, there is no need for a definite numbering of the multitude in order for it to be explained as such. God, from without of the multitude, would provide a singular finite explanation. Finite in the sense of numerically finite, infinite power. Okay. So maybe the problem with actually infinite multitudes is that they could not be collected by aggregation. And that is the way things typically work in nature. Infinite aggregation, however, would not be a problem for a divine creator. Moreover, if such a multitude were a causal order, supposedly providing its own explanation, then it would seem that it would be inexplicable because an infinite order is always incomplete. However, if the infinite multitude were explained externally, ultimately it is not an independent causal order, then it would seem that it could have a complete explanation even if it were infinite. Thus, we might not be entirely without reasons to entertain, consistent with much of what Aquinas has argued earlier, that a really infinite multitude is epistemically possible. We can't rule it out. God might have done it. Moreover, if such an infinite multitude cannot be absolutely ruled out, However improbable, we cannot absolutely rule out the infinity of the world. Is any of this a defensible, airtight argument? Hardly, right? Or at least I haven't come close to providing you with such an argument today. And I do worry that St. Thomas has not been entirely consistent on this issue. Okay, but I think we can gloss this a little bit. Nevertheless, since all that he needs is epistemic possibility, the bar is really low here. He just needs for all we know. All right. Thank you.
We have some time for questions. Is Clement here in the front?
Thank you, Professor Madden. That was
sure.
Quite the mental workout.
Sorry. You should feel it from my end.
Do you think the tension between question 7 and question 46, text 6 and text 9 is dissolved if Aquinas is a presentist? You know, he only thinks present things exist. If an infinite Pratchett M's series is possible and all those causes continue to exist, you know, put aside that example about fathers generating sons, but if A causes B, B causes C, but the causation of C by B doesn't depend on the causation of B by A, and those just still continue to exist, then you have an actually infinite multitude. But if only present things exist.
Right.
Then you wouldn't.
In an earlier draft, I claimed Aquinas was a presentist in the paper. And then I realized, I'm not 100% sure on that. But I tend to think of him as a presentist, right? I'm inclined to say, I'm inclined to think that he's a presentist. Now, whether or not that makes the two passages consistent, I'm not sure that it does, because the first passage is not about the world at all. It's just, I don't think you can have a completed infinite in any sense, right? And the second passage seems to say, no, we can have them, right? I think what a presentist claim would show is, well, the duration of the universe just isn't a completed infinite, right? Now, if you're four-dimensionalist or something, I think you've got a real problem with that, okay? So I think making Aquinas a presentist might help the overall debate, but I don't think it helps the consistency of those two passages. By the way, there is someone, Frater Anselm of the Norbertines, has, as far as I know, incomplete dissertation on Aquinas and presentism, right? So you might seek out Frater Anselm of the Norbertines. I would like to get my hands on it myself, actually, if you're listening to Frater Anselm.
Hi. This is kind of a subtle, more of a theological question, but I've wondered about it and asked because it's for a long time, which is, could one make a case that there's a subtle heresy involved in maintaining that the finitist model could be demonstrated? Because if you tied in with the idea that we could demonstrate it, then that would seem to involve that we could demonstrate something about God's will. But if it's been taken that God's will can only be known by revelation, then one could be guilty of kind of a subtle rationalism by saying something that's understood to be explicitly knowable only by revelation because it pertains to the will of God was in fact demonstrable to reason. And now it involves sort of a tacit heresy, I guess, in a sense, because it would be a form of rationalism. But we do know that Scripture, I mean, the Church does hold, if I'm not mistaken, that there can be things revealed that are theoretically demonstrable to reason, but maybe not very evident, you know, to the vast majority of people or something. Right. So that might be a way out of that, but I just thought I'd throw that out there and see what your thoughts might be.
Yeah, I think it's a really good worry, and I think it's exactly the worry that Thomas brings up in his claim that you can't demonstrate that the world is infinite, right? Or, and he does it again with the finitude too, to say, well, we don't know the will of God. Okay, my view is I'm talking to Thomas now. I think there's this real mistake in there to think is this modal fallacy between whether or not God had to will that there's a world. That's in fact, he doesn't, right? The question though, whether or not if he wills a world, it has a certain type of duration associated with it. That's a different question. I think that's within the realm of reason, right? So I'm really I get the grip there, but I just think when you start to try to spell it out modally, I don't think there's a problem. Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much for the talk. I think you brought up some really interesting, helpful issues. My question is about the analogy between Kermit the Frog and the world, and I'm wondering if it might be a problem to extend that analogy, because in the case of like Kermit the Frog, you can abstract the essence, and the reason why you can, it seems to me that you can know the proper accidents, like that he's mortal, is because of some external facts about the world, say laws of entropy or whatever else, things come and go out of existence and disintegrate. But in the case of the world, it seems like there might be a disanalogy there, because if we're looking at the world as a whole, it's hard to see how there can be these proper accidents, because there's nothing outside of the world that would make these proper accidents exist. So.
Yeah. I meant to look it up. I didn't do it. I think Aquinas has a demonstration that all material beings are going to go out of existence.
Everything in the sublime.
Yeah, in the sublime. Yeah.
Four elements. Yeah.
Right.
It's not the heavenly bodies. Those are
going to go forever. Because what I was kind of big on is, if he thinks that it's just in the nature of mobility that it's going to go, it's going to fall apart at some point, right? Oh yeah, sorry. So I think Thomas's view is that mobile things, right, whether it's propria or in their essence, are gonna go down, right? And I'm not sure if we're gonna say something like propria are always externally caused, right? You see what I mean? So I would take like wetness as sort of a propria of water, but I don't know that I would say wetness is caused externally. Does that make sense? Yeah, Michael. Yeah. Yeah, and I think this is important, because it's one reason I put some of the paragraphs in there is that when they talk about the world, it's not like contemporary cosmological argument people talk about just this collection of things, like the biggest set or something like that. They're talking about mobile being. So we've got a genus here we're talking about, right? It's not just a randomly collected set. And if there's a genus, then it seems like it should have a definition, and then it's going to have an essence, and we can start talking about the attributes.
So I want to go back to your modal fallacy concern here.
Yeah.
So do you see that in text 2 here? Is that the
text
you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay, because, I mean, now that you raise the question, when I look at that, it would help a lot to see the Latin, but it does look like a pretty quick and dirty way of formulating the argument on Aquinas' part.
I mean,
it is a little unclear. But I took the point to just mean, look, if God wants to will the world to exist finitely, that's up to him. If he wants to will for it to exist infinitely, that's up to him.
Yeah.
So it's not making that kind of fallacy at all. It's saying, it's in the background. Obviously, he doesn't have to will that it exists at all.
Right.
Right? That's up to him. But it's also up to him which kind of world he wants. But the one is not said to follow from the other. I don't see that fallacy.
Unless it's just in mobile being that it's going to be finite. Right.
Right. But he seems to... I'm just getting the impression he thinks that's not the case.
Yeah. But that's where I think the question begging then comes up, because it seems like the other guys really seem to think it's the case.
But it's only a fallacy if he thinks it follows.
Yeah.
In that way.
I see. So
in other words, if he's got it, if he's thinking, but I've already proved, or I will prove later, I can independently of this.
Sure.
Prove,
sure.
It's not cooked into it.
Sure. Yeah, so maybe what I'm doing here, I think, and this is, I shouldn't do this, right, is I'm kind of cooking in to my interpretation of this argument what I think he would say to the question beg reply that I think this thing would get, and then answering that. Do you see what I mean? But your point is to say, well, no, he can just say, well, no, I'm, I don't think the world is the way these guys think it is, and given that, it's up to God to do what he will with this, right?
Right.
And I'm assuming, I think I'm building in that he's wrong already in his objection to the other guys.
Oh, I see.
You see what I mean?
Yes.
Right.
We'll go ahead and move on with two short questions.
Well, this is just a follow-up. I think he kind of does address the modal issue that you're raising in the De Coelo. There where Aristotle argues that nothing necessary is generable or corruptible,
right,
and vice versa. And Thomas takes the trouble to say, well, but this doesn't show that the world, because Thomas agrees with Aristotle that there really are some necessary beings, the heavenly bodies, right? And he thinks that nevertheless they can have had a beginning in time. So he wants to drive a wedge there between necessity and infinite duration. And his argument is that necessity.
And in the third way, too, he does that.
That wouldn't be implicit there.
Yeah.
That necessity means a possibility not to be, right?
Right.
But that means that they don't have the potency not to be.
Yeah.
He said the potency only regards the present and the future, not the past. So they only have that, or lack the potency not to be, and only have potency to be once they are.
Right.
Not before that.
So you know,
he does address it.
Yeah, no, I like that a lot, actually. In thinking about this, I thought about the third way. You know, and you have, he distinguishes between necessity
and
temporality, right?
Yeah,
and so I thought about going back into that text and saying, well, no, so the issue here isn't necessity, though, it's temporality. And if we took out, like, all the references to necessity out and put temporality in, right, then I think the problem gets worse then for him, because then now the question is, how long has it been around, right? And if there are certain things that just in their natures have to have been around for an infinite duration or for them to be
necessary things, then,
but that right. But necessary in what, like, necessary in what sense? Like, they're not.
If they intrinsically have an infinite duration, they must be necessary
beings. In this de dicto sense, like, there couldn't be a world without them, or
no. In the de rate sense,
right.
De Rey necessity only regards the present and the future. That's
right.
His argument.
Right. Then I think I'm missing you. Because then isn't the question then, granting, I'm happy to grant, that, you know, Thomas thinks that there are De Rey necessary things.
That doesn't tell us anything about whether they existed forever.
Exactly. Right. And so to say that, you know, it's up to God whether or not De Rey necessary things be, right, agreed, that doesn't answer the question. The question is whether or not there have to be those day rate necessary things, or, like, because the question is, if you have them, if there are to be day rate necessary things, right, then they're going to be around forever, right?
No, that doesn't follow. That's what he says doesn't follow.
Right.
Maybe we can work on that.
I thought I want to hear more about it.
Thank you, Dr. Madd. So I'm wondering, in text 3, whether what Aquinas says about demonstration there is in tension with the demonstrations he gives for the existence of God. So, right, I mean, he says that the essence of a thing is the principle of demonstration.
Yeah.
But by that, he surely can't mean that the only things that are allowed to go into, you know, like Aristotelian syllogistic demonstrations are the definitions of things. Because he thinks the first way is a demonstration. And what he has in the first way is the empirical observation that things are in motion. You might think it belongs to the essence of mobile being that it be mobile, but it certainly doesn't belong to the essence of mobile being that it be in motion. So he has an empirical premise in the first way. He takes the first way to be a demonstration. So we can't think that the only things that can go into demonstrations are the essences of things. And given that, I wonder what he would think about the empirical evidence we are in possession of for the finitude of the world from contemporary cosmology. I just want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, first of all, I'm not, because in the first part of your question, good question. I'm not sure Thomas. I'm just not sure if Thomas would say you could have a mobile being that never moved, right?
But just think about the way you phrase it, right? He doesn't, in the first way, even if he thinks that, that's not the way he argues in the first way. The way he argues in the first way is it's evident to the senses that things are in motion. He doesn't say, there are mobile things, therefore they must be moving at some time. And in fact, right, the fact that there are mobile beings is something he's deducing from the observation of things being in motion. So the inference is going the other way.
But isn't that just analytic, right? I mean, that there are mobile things because there are things moving. I mean,
yeah, sure. That's analytic. But I'm saying it's getting that from an empirical, right? Starting with I observe.
But I don't think an Aristotelian has to say we don't get to the first principles of demonstration empirically.
Yeah, but things being in motion is not a first principle of demonstration. That's a premise of the argument.
Right. Right. No, I agree.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Mann.
Thank you.